would. I forgot his name.
So oh, okay. I can do it myself. Okay, so it's a great pleasure to have Chaobin Jian to talk about the paper that he's the host of. Both at the KITP and Station Q, he will alternate. Thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me to speak here, and then thanks for coming. Yeah, so today I will be telling you about, first of all, how gravity works in the Hamiltonian formalism and what is asymptotic symmetry. Asymptotic symmetry, especially in within the Hamiltonian formalism, and also why the ADS-3 or perturbed ADS-3 divides through a center extension, a non-trivial center extension of the asymptotic symmetry of perturbed ADS-3.
Yeah, so
the thing is, I'm not completely sure, what to set up the whole thing. I'm not sure, how basic I need to get to. So if I'm talking about something that everybody knows, just please tell me. And I'm also having a little bit of trouble maybe speaking the most accurate language. So if you have problem understanding what I'm actually talking about, just
we will forgive you for that part.
But yeah, please ask. I mean, just in case that I'm using a word, not particularly important, but maybe means something very important to you, and then we can clarify what's happening there.
Uh-huh. Okay. But
first, let's just start with something very basic, just Hamiltonian formalism in general, just to set it up. For, let's say, particles. Yeah, so to describe the state of the particle, you need like a set of canonical variables. You have coordinates, which are usually denoted as q, I. For example, if it's just one particle in three space, then I will be running from 1 to 3, and then it's momentum. And then, now we come to the most important thing, which is the Hamiltonian of the system, which is a function of the coordinates and the momentum. It's a function, but it determines the whole dynamics of the system. I mean, of course, I'm going to tell you how. We have this, all right.
So by Hamiltonian, you will be always mere classical Hamiltonian, or you will talk about quantum?
Right, so right now, just think of Q and P as classical variables, commuting numbers, real or C, if you will. And then this just is a function.
So it's just a classical Hamiltonian.
At this level. At this level, yes. And actually, throughout the talk, they will just stay classical.
So it's all classical?
It's all classical.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Even in field theories, you will see very soon. Before I tell you how the Hamiltonian determines the dynamics, let me introduce a very important notion first, which is sort of a thing that basically will be there for the whole talk, which is the Poisson bracket. The Poisson bracket is something that looks like that. Put two things in here, and the two things can be any function of the canonical variables. For example, you can have functions like, let's say, you have functions f of q and p, g of function g of q and p, and their Poisson bracket are defined to be, well, it's defined to be this. So it's really written this way. It's just defined to be that partial I minus the one with g and f switched. You can see that, obviously, this is anti-symmetric upon exchanging x and g, and then it has something to do with the choice of canonical variables. But in fact, looking at this form, it seems like it really matters what kind of a canonical variable you choose in the system, but this summation and this whole structure is really important. In fact, if you switch from one set of canonical variable to another kosher set of canonical variable, the whole thing would stay invariant.
But I guess I shouldn't ask you, but I will, since you mentioned this. What do you mean by canonical variable?
Canonical.
You can define this?
You can define variable. Yeah, so for example, in free space, you would like to use x, y, z, and then it's conjugate momentum. A very, you know, another simple choice of canonical variable will be, let's say, you use the polar coordinate and its corresponding momentum. That will be a set. Sometimes you can do something even fancier to mix up the momentum and coordinates, but it's...
Would you also call that canonical?
Yes, I will.
So what does canonical mean?
What does canonical mean?
Physically, not mathematically.
That's a good question, actually. I don't know what is a single
definition.
Yeah,
that's why I when you call canonical.
Right, but I don't know. I think in you know when people talk about synthetic geometry,
well, yeah, physics
are,
you have to
yeah,
have
referring to a specific form, and then you can write it in different coordinates. That's pretty much what it is. But physically, we just usually think of coordinates in space. And then there is a set of rules that to bring you from one set of canonical variables to another set, and this rule is, well, it's basically like some sort of a Laurent transformation.
Well, I think it would be important for your talk, right? When you talk about gravity, then you have some trouble.
Well, in fact, maybe this is not something that you would like the best, but I will just fix the coordinate, you know, in a sense, and then we'll just only talk about those sets.
No, I can tell you mathematically what they are. You know, uh-huh. you take a symplectic manifold, you write
down, and then use something like
this double coordinate to make it the standard form.
Yeah,
okay. I don't know basically how you define.
Yeah, this is what you are talking about, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, isn't it just that you have a set of canonical coordinates if the Poisson brackets look like, you know, Q with P is delta, you know, QI with PJ is delta.
Well, I think maybe that's enough, yeah. I'm just trying to be as general as possible, so I refrain myself from saying, you know, anything.
Well, I think this is definitely probably better. I think the symplectic form, you know, here you don't need anything. Here, this is defined without a symplectic form.
Yeah, he's just saying that, like, you know, you can start with one set of coordinates, whichever pairs you want, and then if you choose another pair of canonical coordinates, it will look like, so, for example, QI, if you're sticking QI here, PJ here, we get a delta function.
Oh, you say that's what it is?
And then you could start with something fancier, some other QI tilde, which was not one of these, but some combination of even P's and Q's, but you can still have the same relation. And if you can find a whole set of these things, then... But this is like starting from one set of a canonical variable to another, so, you know, this is... more well-defined than
but that is not a well-defined problem. Otherwise, we can't quantize gravity. This is exactly the problem. We don't know how to quantize, right? In the end of the day, you cannot tell us you can quantize gravity.
I'm not going to tell you.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Right. Well, in fact, if you search for, if you look up Wiki, the formalism is sometimes referred to canonical quantum gravity.
Yeah,
funny name.
That's wrong.
Well, yeah, whichever way you want to call it, it's not quantum. Okay, this is the Poisson bracket. And it looks a lot like the commutator in quantum mechanics. And in fact, it will be if you really quantize the theory. But we're not going to do that. I introduce notion first to tell you what the Hamiltonian dynamics is. In fact, I don't have to, but this makes life easier. This is the Hamilton equation. So it looks pretty nice, but in fact, it is really just this. So partial H, partial P. So imagine if your Hamiltonian is just momentum squared, then taking the derivative is just giving you momentum, which is pretty much just the velocity, q dot. And then this is the force, because you know if you have a p squared plus some potential, some function of q, then that potential would give rise to a force that changes the momentum. That's it. But thinking it from this perspective, actually, is way more general, than just, you know, thinking about how this eventually boils down to these things. Because eventually, we want to think about age as a generator of time translation, in some sense, so that hence evolution. And whatever you want to stick in there, once you calculate the commutator, what is spitted out is the evolution of that quantity. It doesn't necessarily have to be Q or P. It can be anything.
Right.
Before we talk about that, I also want to mention that there's one place where this thing comes from, which is sort of a, you can think of it as a variance of the or something that is basically equivalent to the Hamiltonian formalism, but using a different language. So many people are more familiar with what a Lagrangian is. The Lagrangian is related to the Hamiltonian via a Laurent transformation, hence that you do something like that. Dot H. So you switch from the set of variable p's to q dots. Then using the Lagrangian, you can construct the so-called action is basically that integrator. So why am I introducing this? Because using the action, you can just formulate it in a pretty simple way, as in the Hamilton equation is basically equivalent to doing this with Q, you know, the variable that you want to vary. But to be more precise, I is a function node of Q of T. Right, so you basically want to vary this Q, or this set of Qs, so that the variation of the I is zero. And then if you do the math, which can be simply done, you would end up having the same set of equations. You can do the variation over P's too, but that requires some, yeah, it's not that different. Right. Having these two complementary approaches in mind, later you will see that we will just maybe sometimes switch back and forth between them. You know, you need to sometimes pick the ones that is most convenient for you to do the analysis. Right. Yeah. Okay. So now, having introduced how the dynamics works in general, now let's talk about something more specific, which is conserved quantity. Which might or might not be present in a Hamiltonian system. Let's call them Q. But by conserved, it literally just means that any dynamics, through any dynamical process, its time derivative is zero. But of course, it's a function of Q and P, so it's in fact just asking for this. Right? But you can write it in a more compact form like that. That just means like I plug in the Hamilton. Right.
Isn't that the definition of dot?
The definition of dot, you can think of it as some derived variable from p's and q's. But eventually, I mean, it's not that different. So
I think that the bracket actually gives you the dynamics of the system. Like, that's the way you think.
Yeah, but I mean, you can see it this way. You can see whichever way, nothing will change the answer.
I thought you just asked the dot, just the time derivative.
Yeah, the dot is the time derivative.
No. Sorry,
what's the question then?
Yeah.
That's the definition of the dot, that you have the bracket, and the bracket gives you the dynamics of the system, not just because they come up in this form.
Yeah, but this also worked, right? So
yeah.
It's just maybe a derivation, if you will. I'm just trying to make a point that, you know, the evolution of anything is governed by its commutator with the Hamiltonian. You can think of it as a definition, or effectively, I just derived it from the equation of motion. Does that sound okay? Yeah. Right. So this means it's conserved. So that means that it in some sense commutes with Hamiltonian. Right? But now you notice that this bracket has a structure that allows you to interchange the two with an extra minus sign in the front. And we also know that the Hamiltonian is what generates the time transition. Right? So it means that Q under time translation is invariant. But let's suppose if you think of it this way. Let's just imagine at this point that Q takes the place of Hamiltonian, some fictitious sense. It generates some action, not a long time direction, but some transformation. Then it would mean that the Hamiltonian is invariant under that kind of action. Right? So that's sort of a classic notion that a symmetry is also always related a conserved charge is also always related to a symmetry. Yeah, and it's by Noether, so you know, it's like some very classic stuff. You can think of this in general. Later I'll give you an example, but you can just take my word for it. In general, this is some transformation generated by Q, and then the change of Hamiltonian is given by this commutator. And then if it's zero, then it means that, well, the two things are related. If Hamiltonian is invariant under a certain transformation, there's a conserved quantum. That's Let's look at how the Lagrangian or the action change under this sort of thing. So we know that variation has two p's, right? A p, and then it has a Lagrangian piece. Hamiltonian piece. We know that, let's say we are already talking about a symmetry, so this thing drops out. We need to understand what this is. So we follow the standard way of doing the variation, but right now here you want to do an integral by part to move the dot from here to here. So minus sign, and then you get a total derivative. So again, if you look at this whole thing, in fact, this is just dq. dt. Because now I declared that the variation is generated by q, so there's some relation of those kinds. How the transformation generated by symmetry Q looks. If you switch the Q to H, then it's just a Hamiltonian. And so the whole thing actually doesn't vanish, but it's a total derivative. So basically, throughout the trajectory, the only variation is happening on its boundary. That's how usually an action behaves under a global symmetry action. Yeah. So all this is telling you that basically a conserved quantity, Q, is always closely tied to a tied to a symmetry of the Hamiltonian.
I'm confused by your computation. That's plus a equal or not?
Sorry.
There's a plus. That equal the dq dt, and then have a plus dt ddt. That's a equal sign or there's a plus sign?
This is a plus sign.
Where did that plus come from?
Oh, so you do an integral by part. So this dot was on here, and then I moved
it. That's come from you move the dot.
Yeah, that's from moving the dot.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, right. Actually, maybe let me just move on a little bit on this. So this would tell you that basically you are doing, you know, the integral of Q minus, this whole thing. Usually you fix the boundary conditions so that the delta Q is zero on the two ends, on the upper and lower limit of this integral. And so this thing vanishes. And then if you say that, oh, this is a completely, like a, if the Hamiltonian and everything is completely symmetric under this transformation, then of course delta I has to be zero. Just the trajectory just pretty basically looks exactly the same as before. Or maybe just shift it by a value that doesn't change the value of I, then you know that the difference in Q before and after, between the initial and the final condition will give you the same result. In that way, you can also see that if this thing is zero, then that means there's a conserved quantity.
Sorry, charge.
Yeah. Just to give a very quick example, if you take the Hamiltonian to be just p square, just like that, simple enough. You know that, of course, energy is conserved, but that's not the thing I want to talk about. We want to say that, obviously, momentum is conserved. So right now, the conserved charge, the conserved quantity, which I sometimes refer to as charge, what should just be the momentum itself, right? And then what does it do as a symmetry transformation? This is a generator, right? So usually you associate a small number with it.
Why choose p? P squared would do too, right?
P squared would do too, yeah, but p squared is the energy. So like it has different...
It has p cubed.
You can't do that. Yeah, it's the same thing.
Okay, so...
Yeah. You can combine any two symmetry of the system to make a third symmetry, so that's like a, But let's just do it as a very simple example, you know, what does this Poisson bracket do to spatial coordinate, Q? So epsilon is just a small number that controls the amount of transformation you do, and Q is the generator. The charge is the generator of the transformation. So if you do that, then you know the answer is epsilon, very simply. So that means that the charge generates the translation of the space. And also you know that the Hamiltonian doesn't explicitly contain Q, and it's translationally invariant. Right? So this is basically the simplest demonstration of all those slightly more convoluted language. Okay, so enough for particles. Now we get to something slightly fancier. basically some sort of a souped-up version of this Hamiltonian dynamics, but involving fields in the space. By fields, I mean that there are some fields living in ambient space. So right now, here you see that I've already included the possibility that you have various of different coordinates labeled by I. But when it comes to fields, you will still have a bunch of coordinates, but now these coordinates will be labeled by not I, but you can just switch it to the spatial coordinates. So everything will just become a sort of a function, functional analysis kind of a generalization of all those ideas. But let me just very quickly go through those things. So variables, canonical variables. Let's just call them phi of x, pi of x for the moment. Okay. You can think of the x as a generalization of label either. Then now the Hamiltonian will look like a functional of these two functions, which often takes the form of this, depending on spatial dimension. Sometimes it refers to this thing. This is the whole Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian density, so-called. Something like that. Okay.
Yeah.
So this field lives on space or space-time?
You can do whatever you want. Yeah. Can be space or space-time. But usually we talk about space-time because we need time. So if without space, then it's just going back to the original case. Yep, right. Okay. So everything is pretty much the same, so now you just have to tweak the bracket a little bit, like the Poisson bracket, to suit this definition. And I think you can already imagine what it will be. So given two functional, f of phi pi, g of phi pi, their Poisson bracket will be integrated over space or time, if you will. Delta f, delta phi of x, delta g, delta phi of x minus. Had before. Right. Okay. So nothing very fancy. So this already tells you how to do fields. Modulo the details of doing the functional derivative in the most rigorous sense. But
x should really only be integrated over space, right?
Sorry. X is integrated over space. That's
okay,
right.
That
you're
the,
right. Sorry. Yeah, yeah, maybe. Yeah, so this is really
integrated.
Spatial
integral.
Spatial integral, yeah. So
okay.
If you're doing this, then you're doing a D plus 1 D dynamics. That's sort of correcting me.
But now this goes beyond mathematics, right?
Sorry?
Now this goes beyond mathematics. This is more complicated.
Yeah, I know. So that's what I said, that the modulo with details is doing these functional analysis. Yeah, okay. So you can see that nothing really changes except that I replace the summation over I by the integral of x. That's pretty much what I'm going to do. And I can I can as well talk about conserved charges, but of course they will kind of be most likely functionals of these canonical coordinates and canonical momentum of the fields. So, global symmetry, pretty much the same thing. Q, I, and then, you know, same as some invariance under the again, I'm just emphasizing that sort of quantity is related to symmetry. Now, let's get to something slightly more different, which is a thing people sometimes call gauge symmetry. I mean, it depends on who you ask. Sometimes people call it gauge redundancy.
Right. Were P and Q actually supposed to be phi and pi?
Oh, my bad, yes. That's right. Yeah, thanks for pointing it out. Right.
What did you say about giving an AP invariant? What do you mean?
Oh, a symmetry, literal in a literal sense, it means that under certain transformation generated by whatever, leaves the Hamiltonian invariant. Yeah. Okay. But now let's get to something that is not usually encountered when we talk about particles, which is the gauge symmetry. Gauge symmetry, well, sometimes people like to call it gauge redundancy, but let's not just argue about the terminology or explain why, in what sense it looks like a symmetry, and in what sense it's a sort of a distinguished kind of a symmetry compared to the global symmetry. So, for global symmetry, we usually have a conserved charge that has a zero time derivative. If you really imagine gauge symmetry is also a symmetry, you can do that. You will have a conserved charge of some kind, which I call capital phi here. But the difference is, if it's a gauge symmetry, it is strictly zero. Well, I'm going to use this word. This is, I think it's a physical term, it's called on shell. By on shell means that when you plug in the solution of the equation of motion. So of course, if something is always zero, then it definitely satisfies this criteria, but not vice versa. For example, as I show you, this very trivial case, right, then you can have a conserved charge, which is the momentum. You can have it, whatever value you want, you will have a solution of this kind with this conserved charge.
Let me get a definition right first. You're saying we define gauge symmetry as any functional which is zero on shell.
Yes.
And there are no gauge group involved. Just
I don't think I need the notion of gauge group.
Yeah. It's just any functional which is zero on shell. You would call that a gauge symmetry.
So physically, it means that, I mean, what this means is that, you know, different conserved, different evolution, different trajectory of the system can be, in a way, labeled by different conserved charges. But if the conserved charge can only take one single value, then it probably doesn't really mean anything, or it doesn't distinguish any physical motion. In physics terms, it also means that, in fact, when this as a generator, acting on the evolution or acting on the states, it does nothing. Especially on the physical variables.
When you write on this as a function of a phi pi, do you mean any function, or it's just like a polynomial in derivative or something?
I don't think I'm restricted to. In all examples I've seen, it's like polynomial, derivative, and all those things.
Well, I'm thinking if you just take the equation of a motion and take like a third power or something, that would be something like this, right?
Oh, you're asking if the time translation is a gauge symmetry? In a way, I think you can. You can always reparametrize time. Okay. In that sense, it looks kind of looks like a gauge symmetry. Yeah. And in
if it's a standard definition, where did you get this definition? Never seen this one.
Yeah.
This paper?
No, so this is a lecture note that I steal. Actually, I have no idea who this person is, but this lecture note is quite amazing. and then, in fact, I think, I didn't tell you where it comes from, but later you will see that this is indeed how people kind of classify it.
It's a very general definition. So.
Yeah, it's a very general definition. But of course, when you have this, you can always, when you have this wave functional, you can kind of always think about how it leads to changes. So actually, I wanted to talk about the electromagnetism as a very good example of this, but I'm not sure I'm having enough time for that. I probably need to skip that one, but let's try to incorporate the idea and then tell you along the way why this is true. So now let's put it into the context of gravity, which is in a way one of the most complicated gauge theory you can cook up in a physical context. Einstein gravity, let's put it more precisely. Yeah, so we all know that if you want to have an action principle to describe Einstein gravity, you need to talk about this Einstein-Hilbert action. 3 plus 1 dimension. Well, this is really the integration over space-time because I'm talking about the action. R, curvature scalar. This thing is the cosmological constant. You may or may not have it, but if you want to have an empty de Sitter space, you better have it. Because these are negative numbers. Yeah. So, but imagine that if you want to consider a Hamiltonian formalism, you really need to distinguish the space and time. And then you're thinking of some co-dimensional one manifold evolving in the space-time, right? Like you think of a foliation of the space-time along the time direction. So there's something you need to do first to decompose this G, to incorporate that notion first. So metric, proper distance square is usually just written as this. Okay, but now I would like to write it in a very specific form. Dt, we need to have time. Plus the metric itself is already diagonal, not having, this is the TT component, this is the spatial component. I will use Roman variable for the spatial components, and Greek variable is for space-time. So then this n will be just 0, which makes total sense. But if you have something like here, in fact, I'm not totally sure why this is the right way to do it, but let me just proceed and see what's going on there. Right. But one thing for sure is that if you write things in this way, I should maybe say that this is the determinant of G when you view it as a matrix mu mu. Okay? If you write it this way, this has a very simple expression. At least, maybe just for this purpose, you can think of it this way. Determinant of G, ij, as a square matrix of one less dimension times n.
Are you doing Euclidean signature or is it still Lorentzian?
Lorentz signature.
Sorry.
In square. Okay. So at least it factorized pretty well. And then you can try to say it like pull out the timepiece.
Easy, you know,
to make it slightly easier if you use these things. And then, now it's a very, now here comes a very interesting rewriting of the same thing.
Is it only just a constant? I don't understand the formula. So you have just here, n squared plus ni.
Which one? Yeah. Here? Oh, this thing?
Yeah, so
these are, so basically, it's the same amount of information as in G mu mu. It's just that I choose to use not GTT, not GTI, but instead use these n's to reparametrize them. Okay? Using these things, actually, this piece is kind of what I just talked about. You can factorize this very easily. So this whole thing can be written as this, no problem. So to factorize already pretty nicely, and you have a clear, you don't have like a weird mixture between space and time here. And what's here is this. So bear with me here, it's slightly complicated. Kij. Basically the extrinsic curvature. Extrinsic curvature determined by just G. So there's a couple notation that I need to explain here. So look at this, there are some upper and lower indices here. So they are converted using the G, just the G itself. It has nothing to do with, well, not nothing to do, but it's just that yeah, you need to convert the lower and upper indices using the G, just the spatial metric. And then notice that I have a sort of a slash here. It means the covariant derivative with respect to this G, just the spatial, in a sense, the spatial covariant derivative, not the space-time one. Right. But
what is K?
K is defined by this. Is the
extreme. This is KIT, but you have a K without the
index. Oh, it's the one with the contracted.
Uh-huh.
Contracted with GIJ to make it a scalar. Yeah. So, in a way, you can call this the kinetic term. Just like the kinetic energy. The reason is that, you know, this is the only piece that contains something dot in it. So if you write a Lagrangian, you know, when you see x dot squared, you know that's a kinetic term. So this is why I call this whole piece kinetic term. And also we notice that there's only the kinetic, there's only a dot associated to the spatial metric, Gij. There's no time derivative on the ends, none of them, okay? So this actually gives you something that is very different from what I just tell you very simply slightly different from the general formalism that I gave you. And then this piece just have no time derivative, and it's totally a function of G. Okay? Right. So you follow the drill. if you've had this, and then you notice that there's some time derivative, you notice that, okay, this is sort of maybe a physics instinct here, that these are the coordinate that you want to think about.
So you are thinking this whole bracket is Hamiltonian now?
No, not yet. This whole thing is still the action written in a funny way, if you will. And presumably now I've have you know a well separation between, you know, this is a time integral. So this whole piece, well, it's from here.
This is your I.
This is the L.
L.
This is, yeah, you're going to give it this whole thing as the L, right? And then you need to do the standard Laurent transformation to go from L to H.
The n should actually go inside the x integral because it's space dependent.
Oh, yes, you're right. Thank you.
What is n?
N is a part of the, yeah, it's called the lapse function. It's, you can think of it as some component of the GTT. Part of the metric.
So we had g, but then we wanted to make it look nicer, and
yeah,
we
like that.
Took n's out.
Yeah. So I mean, for any g mu nu, you can just rewrite it in this way.
So we just like this form.
You just like this form. Yes.
We're separating space and time.
Yeah.
Contrary to what one usually does.
Exactly. Yeah, because I mean, Hamiltonian formalism in this way is an awkward formalism that you really need the time direction to evolve something along, so that's why you need, yeah. So I guess it's just that in hindsight, if you do this decomposition and follow all these calculations, you notice that there's this nice separation that you're good to proceed.
So it's still relativistic, but it's being hidden very well.
Yeah.
Is this separation canonical? It is dependent on the metric?
Dependent on the coordinate.
No, this...
Depends on the
coordinate. Yeah, but yeah, so dependent on the coordinate, but for any given G, you can... It's just simple algebra to decompose it. It's like a matrix algebra done separately on each point.
Graham Schmidt or something.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it's just this...
Actually, it's not the full Graham Schmidt.
So, yeah, so this is the G mu nu.
Just one step.
Yeah, and then you want to basically make these things zero.
Right.
And then you have, like, this piece and this piece. You end up having this G and this N, in here.
But then this decomposition determines your future choice of canonical variables.
Yes.
So it's not a good, well, not an obvious choice.
It's not an obvious choice, but I guess it's just that if you, let's say you do it, and then you find out a nice separation, then you can proceed. So it's the same thing, even if you do, like, you know, Hamiltonian formalism for particles, there's still a freedom of choice of canonical variables. Those cases are much more obvious than this situation here.
I think what's nice about it is that time derivatives of n and ni don't appear.
Yeah, and you will see that's a very important thing in the whole story. Yeah, okay, so now we notice that since these have derivatives, so they're called these are canonical variables, and they will have their conjugates.
This is in the paper you are talking about, or this is just some background material?
This is some background material.
So it's not in the paper.
Yeah, I mean, they just jump right into the form. It's I think if I don't set it up,
yeah,
it's not totally not understandable.
That's what you need to do too.
Yeah. That this whole thing is L, so that is just an exercise. Pretty simple. Stat. Okay. But now, the Hamiltonian should be written as you do the Laurent transformation. One is upper, one is lower. My minus L. Now here comes the most important thing. It's the cornerstone of all analysis that you want to do later. Look like that. Okay, and these there are several things. H is a function of, H is just a function of. I will get to the physical meaning of these things immediately. It's pretty complicated, but okay. So something, but right now we come to a point that to proceed, you will see something very different from the standard Hamiltonian formalism, which is that you have these functions that has basically no time derivative. You want to know like how to deal with them. They have no time derivative, hence you have no idea what their dynamics is.
First, what is HI?
Yeah, HI is this.
Oh, that's the
idea. Yeah, so it's just some expression. But so right now you're going to deal with this different variables that doesn't have any dynamics. And in fact, now it's time to turn back to the action principle. So now the action actually relies on all these ends, and you can say that they're functions of variables, or they're function nodes of the kind of variables. So we would like to say that, in fact, right now, just the Hamiltonian formalism doesn't tell you what the ends have to do, but this does. This is the action principle. Delta, variation of I is zero on classical trajectory. But now it has more ingredient because it's not only varying these canonical variables, but also varying these end functions. But if the dependence is simply like this, then you know that they are just Lagrange multipliers, and then they will just enforce these conditions. Looking pretty simple. Okay, so now it tells you that the dynamics has to satisfy some conditions such that these things are always zero on shelf. Okay? So this is something that I kind of mentioned previously. If you have something that always evaluates to zero, it might be a gauge symmetry. And indeed, you can actually just check if you are if you want to just convince yourself. For example, well, this thing generates a time evolution. This is more complicated to deal with, but this one is much easier. It's just a very simple pi, but with some derivative and some contraction.
Oh, what was it, the i/j then?
Oh, i/j is the covariant derivative with respect to g, ij.
Covariant derivative of what?
Of pi I, so pi ij was a canonical variable, right?
Yeah.
And then you can do derivative along certain directions, but you can do covariant derivative, it's called slash, and then you need to contract to get this thing. Yeah, so it just takes several steps, but nothing fancy. Yeah. So in fact, this thing secretly contains derivatives and some information about a g in this form, if you want to write it out explicitly. You can proceed, I mean, if you're having this form, you can ask, what does this thing look like?
So yeah, since there's a big symmetry, you went better. They are zero, not even on, because completely zero.
No, there you need to take the equation of motion, like the variation of the ends to set
no,
it to.
I assume this is zero on shell.
Zero on shell, yeah. So for any physical realization in the system, it evaluates to zero. But of course, as a function, you can just take whatever value you want. But I say that this is a gauge symmetry. You may want to test what exactly they are, right? And then, so as I say, that if you have some conserved charge, obviously it is conserved over zero. You can do this just having some small parameter, some vector field, xi I, dotted into it to make a scalar out of it. And this is a scalar function in the space. You can do the Poisson bracket, see what you get. And in fact, you get this. Expensive. Yeah, so the comma means just the plain derivative. But yeah, you stare at it for a while, you notice immediately that this is the transformation of G, delta G, under the coordinate reparametrization. So to be more precise, you define a new set of coordinates which you call x tilde I to be this, and then the metric, the spatial metric should satisfy this rule, obviously. Or let's just put it this way. You can go ahead and work out what the delta G is, and it's exactly that. So you see that, okay, now it's, I think it's pretty safe to call it a gauge symmetry because it's just a reparametrization of the manifold. And of course, it's not physical, but I guess depending on what your standard is, but you can call it a symmetry. And it just have no consequence on any physical manifolds. But it tells you that the system is inherently consistent upon reparametrizing the manifold. And of course, you can do something fancier to combine these whole thing, and you can have all sorts of reparametrization among space and time. That's just the space component. Okay?
So is this, what's the connection then between time evolution and reparametrizations of time?
Well, I guess as Jung Han said, that the evolution. Well, so this evaluates with zero, right? So it definitely is related to some sort of gauge symmetry, given the standard we had just now. And then, and this whole thing generates how the thing evolves in the time direction. If you just do it, let's say calculate the Poisson bracket and how it acts on, so you will have time derivatives there, but it's actually zero. So, yeah, it governs the. So that's the weird thing about gravity. The Hamiltonian is always zero on a shell, which is not always true for a generic field or something else. Yeah, but that in fact generates the time evolution. But you know that in a space time manifold, you can always have the freedom to reparametrize time. So its conserved charge is better than zero because that looks like a gauge.
Those are really two different roles of this H. I mean, on the one hand, it should generate time evolution, on the other hand, it should be zero because of.
Right, so yeah, so when you evaluate this, you have no idea if they're on shell or not. Okay, I guess here, really, what you know is that this H should have been the thing that governs the time evolution, but given its weird structure, having these N fields here, you know extra information about these things. And then, I think it's just, for me, it's just a result, an interpretation coming from the calculation of the Poisson bracket, something like that. You know that this thing generates the spatial, the reparametrization of the spatial manifold. You can as well do things using that, and then presumably that would relate, well, that would be related to the reparametrization along the time, involving the time direction as well.
I mean, the issue is that you're asking about time evolution along some time coordinate that you've chosen arbitrarily at the start, and so that evolution is really meaningless. It's just you could just change what you mean by this original t. If you put in some physical boundary, which I assume we're going
to
do,
we'll get to that.
Then you've sort of fixed what you mean by time with reference to that boundary, and then you find that the Hamiltonian is not identical to zero. So you have some notion of time evolution.
Yeah, I forgot you wrote that. Did you write out the Lagrangian at all? Did
this is the Lagrangian.
Is the first derivative
this,
there?
Which
is
one?
The first derivative here now? Oh, there's a first.
There is some first derivative here.
Kind of like trisagonal theory. There's a first derivative.
No, it's squared.
Oh, so it's first derivative squared.
Yeah, it's derivative squared. Yeah. This is in general dimension.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I wrote three, but it doesn't matter actually. Okay. So. To further strengthen the point that these are gauge symmetries, especially when you have a bunch of them, all can be dotted or multiplied by some field, scalar, or vector, you want to think about how they affect each other. Let's say each of the H, you can kind of already imagine the Poisson bracket is kind of like a Lie bracket. Then now you may wonder, what if I do commutators of the H's? What's the Lie algebra between them? And in fact, you can do that. These things. Just calculate these Lie brackets. Loosely speaking.
Last two are zero.
Sorry?
Are they supposed to be zero for the lower two?
If you put the on-shell value, it's zero, but you have to evaluate the Lie bracket first before you plug in anything. So these are, So in fact, you can check that they form a pretty simple closed algebra. I was just not right. It's closed. So. So the expression can be written in terms of H and derivative of H. So they form a closed algebra. In that sense, it's even, give you a stronger evidence that they actually form something like a symmetry group, a pretty large one. And those are the gauge symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. But so right now we are at the position to introduce conserved charges in the Hamiltonian formalism. So one thing I wasn't able to explain to you was that the connection between gauge and, well, I explained only a little bit, the connection between gauge and global symmetry. I say that the gauge symmetry is often a very special kind of global symmetry, but also, on the other hand, a gauge symmetry kind of inherently is built on a certain global symmetry. not sure what would be a very good example, but let's say you imagine this reparametrization of the space and time. You can reparametrize them any way you like with any arbitrary function to C, and it will lead to certain changes which will have no consequences because this, as I explained, will look like a gauge symmetry in the system. But if you choose Ci to be a constant function, then all of a sudden it becomes the translation. And as I have kind of demonstrated, at least in the single particle case, a translation symmetry should lead to the conservation of momentum. Right. So in this case, you see that they are kind of related. In fact, maybe you can think of, well, in fact, you can always think about the gauge symmetry containing the global symmetry in a certain way. If you think about it more carefully, the gauge symmetry are usually localized in space. For example, you can have this cassie to have a finite support on a bounded region, and those has to be related to gauge symmetry. But when you do a translation, it's like everything shifts. This is a constant function, right? So it's not bounded, not having local support in the space, and it somehow crosses over to the global symmetry. Right. Okay. So somehow you can kind of say that the gauge symmetry can, now I'm going to use the word asymptotically commuted, transmuted to global symmetry. Right. Okay. Let's see how exactly this happens in the gravity system. So,
yeah, this is not a procedure of something. This is like a universe of gauging asymmetry.
Yeah, so I was afraid that if I say gauging asymmetry, I would.
Well, this is the universe
people,
gauging asymmetry.
Yes, exactly, but I'm not sure if this is a notion. How in mathematical terms should I say gauging asymmetry?
I don't think it's a mathematically defined gauging asymmetry.
I think
this is UN words.
Yeah, so I think this is the closest that I can get to gauging the symmetry. Okay, but yeah, let me not erase this whole thing. Remember, I tell you that the way I arrive at these things is to take the variation at the ends, right? But now I'm going to do it slightly more carefully. One question you might ask immediately is that, you know, what are the phase space that I'm talking about? What are the ends? Like, you know, what is the functional space that I'm varying inside? Especially when you are allowed to have spatial infinities, you know, are these L2 functions or whatever, you need to kind of specify. And more importantly, let's say if you pin down certain asymptotic values of n, let's say that's the way we do it, then you might not be able to vary the n however you want. Meaning that there might be parts of these things that are not zero, right? So basically, you can think of a mode decomposition. This is really what I'm right here is really maybe say, it is originally a function of pi and g and pi, but they are functions of space. So you can kind of say that they're functions of space, and they take zero values because of the variation of these n's. But if you say that there are certain modes of n that are not allowed to vary, then you wouldn't be able to set them to be zero. But those are still conserved. So now you have some conserved quantity that are allowed to take non-zero value, and those will be referred to global symmetries in the gravitational system. In fact, people have been trying to do this systematically just gauge fields like electromagnetism or non-abelian gauge fields or gravity or even string theory. Whenever you have a gauge symmetry. This is the way to really identify which part of the gauge symmetry becomes global symmetry. Asymptotically. Okay? But to really formalize it, you want to make things, you want to have basically a nice formalism. Remember, I tell you that the Hamiltonian, finding the global symmetry. Finding the global symmetry charge more specifically.
Oh, okay, I want to ask you to find the gauge symmetry charge. Does it make sense to define a gauge symmetry?
Yeah, you have a
ray charge. You
have those
are
the gauge symmetry charge.
Oh, that's not right.
Charge. Yeah, the charge is always zero. That's the thing.
Always zero.
Yeah. So a symmetry with charge always zero is a gauge symmetry. A charge acting on the
that you're not changing anything.
Yeah, okay. Right. So dot dot dot.
I won't be here, so how long you need?
I'm not here next week.
Oh,
so I'll miss.
How long do you need?
I think I can wrap up in 10 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Seems like you're just starting the paper. So.
No, I think we'll.
Oh no, I mean I think the rest of it. Some of them are just like calculations, so not really.
You have 17 minutes.
Yeah.
17. Yeah, I think that's good enough for me. So basically, okay, maybe I need to speak faster.
I won't interrupt you then.
Huh?
I will let
you finish. Yeah. It's just that. Okay. Yeah. So originally, I have shown you that Hamiltonian takes certain form and how it depends on n's and pi's and g's. But really, to run the Hamiltonian formalism, you need to know the functional derivative, right? Because that's the thing you check into. That's the thing you need for the Poisson bracket. So presumably, you would really like to have something like that, right? A variation. And then it has a piece that is linear in this and linear in that. Right? Then you can take the functional derivative. I'm not sure how mathematically rigorous this is, but that's sort of the logic. But in fact, it's not so nice. In fact, if you really do it, because you're given the form already, you will have a boundary term. You need to do a certain integrate by parts. This is like a boundary term. Integrate over some manifold like surrounding the whole space at spatial infinity, you have some horrible expression, which just I'm just writing it here so that you know there's such a thing, but it's not really that you can. Not that I can pull any immediate physical meaning out of it. Okay, some very horrible stuff. So, so that means that this is not the only thing when you do the variation, and that could screw up you up if you do the Poisson bracket, and you better have these things vanishing. Then, given this form, you at least have some guidance what to think about. For example, let's say you restrict your phase space, however way you want to fix it. But you may have some restriction on what the variation of g is asymptotically in spatial infinity, right? And then you might have some values of n there. But the goal is, well, not the goal, but it's just that if this thing, given the proper boundary condition, if this whole thing just vanished at spatial infinity, then you're okay, right? You're fine. It basically just goes back to this. There is a situation where the boundary condition is so bad, this thing just blows up, then you cannot even do the Poisson bracket, so that's terrible. But there's a situation where this thing, whole thing saturates to a constant, which is a situation, in fact, you can remedy. And it actually carries physical meaning. So we call this the boundary term. It's a function of the gas. Okay. So it's those cases that are very important. As I told you, that if you're allowed to vary the n's freely, then you will set all of these charges to zero. But in fact, there are certain cases in B, this thing goes to a constant. And the way to remedy this problem of having something extra beyond this is just to take this out of the Hamiltonian. Take this piece out of the Hamiltonian. It's just purely a boundary term. So I would redefine H would be the H naught, well, not here, minus this boundary term. This B term. Okay.
notice that it depends on the choice of n and n here. There's nothing fixing the n's and n because it's not governed by Hamiltonian dynamics at all. So you can actually choose these. Depending on whether it evaluates to a constant or not, you may or may not subtract some of these in the Hamiltonian. But in this sense, you're taking off some modes of the n from the Hamiltonian, which means that you wouldn't be able to vary it in the Lagrangian or in the and hence you have a chance to have conserved quantity. Okay. Yeah, this is basically the key to define conserved quantity in gravity system. But of course, as I in the process of explanation, you notice that I need to fix a lot of things. I need to fix how these things asymptotically behave in spatial infinity. Okay, so now let's go to ADS space. ADS 3. And asymptotic symmetry. And central extension. Right. By the way, for any, so if you find out that there are certain things that are conserved, you can always, add on top of it some gauge symmetry generator. It doesn't change the result. Well, of course, it changes its functional form. Right. So the form is not unique, but somehow it only depends on. You will see that later. I'll just tell you that eventually it only depends on the asymptotic value of the n. It doesn't care about how the n behaves in the far away from the infinity. Right. Okay. So first, let me get to ADS3. So ADS3 has this metric. This metric space, this space is symmetric and has isometry. There are 6 Killing vectors associated with them, just 6 generators of this group. So each of them is a vector, and in fact, if you chuck in these vectors in here, you do get a finite number. Let's say you pick the one that translates in time, you actually get the energy. If you pick the one that has a constant rotation, even at spatial infinity, then that evaluates the angular momentum. But of course, this is just pure ADS. Nothing is in it, so you should get zero. And that's just one realization. And there are certain cases. Well, there are certainly cases where you get non-zero values. Okay. So I think we have set things up already, so I can just explain to you how to apply it to the situation of ADS3 and deform ADS3. So, of course, you need to have, if you stare at this, you notice that if I take r to infinity, this pretty much looks like that. Leading in R looks like that and plus some higher order terms. And in fact, this is exactly the thing you want to fix at spatial infinity. You can consider all kinds of variation. You can even throw in matters into say the center of the system, but you always want to keep the phase space to be determined by whatever metric that has this asymptotic form at spatial infinity. Okay? And of course, this is only the asymptotic form of the pure ADS3, so all these Killing vectors wouldn't change these forms. So naturally, you can always think about how these 6 Killing vectors enters in here and give rise to conserved quantity. But if you only stare at this asymptotic form, there are way more things you can do. Because if you just look at this part, it looks like a complex plane. line here, yeah? And then it has so many conformal Kaelin vectors. Of course, if you do some conformal transformation right here, you might have a global vector, but you can easily just try to absorb it into R and just do something here to just take it away. Simply put, right now, just staring at this form, you might imagine that there are way more transformation than you can asymptotically do a spatial infinity while keeping the form invariant. But of course, you can, I mean, if you want to really study what they are, you need to, you know, really, really do it. And so, you know, one of the main thing about this paper is to have so they think about this special type of vectors that generate the transformation, capital T, T bar, capital R, capital phi, and capital phi bar are the things to solve for. But, I mean, okay, this is a nonsense, but what I really want to tell you is that if you really put this in and demand that the asymptotically it's invariant, you will immediately kind of see what I just alluded to you, that at least part of the equation just look like the conformal Kaelin equation. You have something like that. Let me just not write others. So once you fix the capital T and phi, you will have the others obtained automatically. So this is the conformal Kaelin equations of two dimensions that strengthen, well, that basically prove the idea of what I just kind of picture, that you can do some conformal transformation here and let it be absorbed by the R, leaving these things in there. So now, you have a lot more vectors to consider, and in fact, if you now remember that phi is compact, I mean, it's just take values from 0 to 2 pi, then you can even write, like, you can do some mode Fourier decomposition of these whole thing, write these vectors in terms of the Fourier component. But those are just technical detail. One thing to note is that there are way more of these than just the Kaelin vector of the ADS tree.
That's true. You didn't write, there's a 1 over r to the 4th, and there's a 1 over r, that's on purpose?
That's on purpose, yeah. That's a kind of determined by how the second leading term in the pure ADS look like. So, in fact, writing it this way is kind of like a just a loose sense. In fact, I need to control what the next term scales like as a function of R. Yeah. Right, that's on purpose. Right. Okay, so given all these vectors, you can directly study their Lie brackets and see what these things are. And then, I think these are just calculations. You can do it yourself if you want to do it, or if you don't, it's on the paper. It's like a long list, but eventually it is just a conformal algebra in the two dimension with zero central charge. I mean, these are just vectors, so no central extension at this point. Right. Okay? But now, at least you have a large whole bunch of vectors to consider, and you want to see what its consequence is when these actors act on the gravitational system and how it affects the charge. Right? But now, you have these vectors, you can just chuck it in here and have a bunch of conserved charges. And you want to calculate the conserved charges in their Poisson brackets to see what's going on there. As I've told you, that these are just kind of some asymptotic form of the gauge symmetry. So at least you know that they should form a closed algebra, as all the generators of the gauge symmetry should have. And it's important to work out what really they are. And also, there is a tricky thing, which is...
How about you summarize these 3 minutes, then people can leave, and
yeah,
we can continue.
I will, yeah. So, the thing is, yeah, one thing to remember at this point is right now, all I've been talking about is this delta B, if you remember things I just erased. So to really fix the form of B, I mean, it's really up to a constant, right? So because I only know what the variation of it is. So I think there's just no standard canonical way to fix it, apart from saying that maybe pure ADS3 is something just have nothing. So you can say that I demand a constant such that zero on ADS3, pure ADS3. Okay? But in a way, this is not so canonical. That's why I think that it gives rise to a central extension, in the sense that you now have a bunch of things, you know, like of this kind. Right? These are just the vectors given rise by those set of equations, and you can study their Lie brackets. Let me just shorten the notation by just writing it this. Right? First thing you notice is that, and this is the calculation they do, you have a first piece that looks like that. And in fact, they show that it has to be a function of the Lie bracket, the two vectors, but there is a chance, there's only a chance at this point it might contain a central extension. But to really calculate a central extension, there's a pretty easy way to do. Because since you know that it's a central extension, and then you can do it wherever you want. I mean, you can evaluate it on whatever metric you want. The easiest place to do it is the ADS3. Because on ADS3, you know all the charges are zero, so this is zero. And then you know what this is. This is basically the change of the charge, let's say eight. The change of the charge defined by this object under a deformation using the eta vectors. Right, so this is literally what it means. And also, you know that before the change, it's ADS3, so it's zero. So it becomes a pretty simple calculation that you're just basically evaluating a certain, the charge value on a given deformed ADS3. And then you get the answer. And you get a, basically, but that's the whole story. You get a, it turns out that it becomes the central extension of the conformal algebra, and then the central charge is related to the ADS radius. That's sort of the end of the story. Yeah.
Let's thank. Okay, we still have questions. I think I will be here. So it seems very complicated, but it's incredible.
Yeah.
Any questions for me? Okay, that took me a game then. So, I forgot what we did the last name. So you say if you compute, the k will come out, but the radius of the
proportional.
These are functions which are defined in configuration.
So you have this hand between H. You have H0.
Yeah.
Then this is the crucial modification, right?
Yeah.
That's just my opinion.
That's right.
Okay.
So
yeah, I think that's how
do you think this
like
can be interpreted as some kind of compensation?
Compensation?
I can tell you why I'm thinking about compensation, but this is related to gauging symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to formulate compensation is to say, okay, you tune the Hamiltonian so that certain field acquired energy is condensed out of the ground state, confined them. So that seems to be, well, at least you have modified the Hamiltonian, right? So that means you probably confine out some of the ground state, you know, field or something.
I'm not sure if I should say confined or not, but I'm certainly eliminating certain modes.
Yeah, you're eliminating certain modes
that show up in the Hamiltonian, but not in the physical system.
Yeah, I think this is, I think that's what I was asking. Maybe, I don't know if there is a way to interpret it as condensation because It's kind of related to what you said. You're finding the global charge, right?
Yeah, I'm finding the global charge. That's right.
So
yeah, in a way, yeah. I see where your intuition.